Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hey, Alex Simmons, it's that time again.
It's been always.
Alex Simmons here with Tell the Damn Story. How are you, Alex Simmons?
I am feeling so good, which I wouldn't have said a couple of days ago because I wasn't feeling that good, but I'm feeling so much better now.
Summer cold is no good.
Yeah, and, it gets in the way of summer fun.
And I'm knowing you, probably summer work, because you're always busy running up and down New York City. And there you go.
Literally up and down subways and buses and all that cool stuff. And again, because of the summer semester, I was working with a number of students, getting them ready for their, some of them are going to be filming their thesis film in another week. Or their dialogue film. And so there's a lot of going over their screenplays and tightening things up and fine tuning and all that, which actually ties in very nicely with what we're going to be doing with today's episode, because this is going to be, let's pronounce this properly now, an Ask the Editors episode.
Yes. Dun, dun, dun. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Today will be Ask the Editors.
No, it's ask
the Editors.
Editors.
Ask the Editors. Yeah. I've got to tell you, I'm a lot calmer with that. Okay. Yeah,
thank you very much. Yes. So we're actually going to hit on two platforms. The first platform is give updates on the sensational Soul Scream anthology. Updates on where we are with all of what Chris has been doing with, and believe me, there's a lot Chris has been doing because Chris is a one-man army.
Dun, 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 dun.
He's one-man editor, writer, all that stuff.
Get to the choppers!
We're going
to
talk about that, and then we're going to also answer some of the most frequently asked questions that we get from writers, young writers, aspiring writers, emerging writers.
And that reminds us, if you haven't watched us before, Tell the Damn Story exists to help aspiring writers and aspiring creatives anticipate the stumbling blocks and the challenges that we've faced. And in updating Soul Scream Anthology for you this week, I will be telling you about exactly those kind of stumbling blocks.
Yes, you will. And so, as a matter, we coined the phrase in the green room. You've run into a few little challenges this week, and we've coined the phrase for those, Chris's cracks. So
that's right.
Come on over
and take a look at my cracks. All right.
Let's talk about the cracks in the skillfully laid out plan that you had for Soul Scream. What happened? How'd you deal with it? So let's start with the beginning, Chris. Take it away.
Soul Scream Anthology, Volume 2. It's subtitled Dark Justice. It's out now and it's live both in paperback and ebook or Kindle, whatever. And predominantly right now available on Amazon. I'm hoping for that to be more platforms later. But like you said, one man band and indie publishing.
Quickly. I just realized what we didn't do. For those people who have never, God, just the shame of it, never listened to us before. What is Soul Scream? Briefly.
Soul Scream Anthology.
Yes, there you go.
Here's the teaser one, which has got Christmas stories. Come All Ye Faithless. And here's the original Volume 1. I'm playing with form here. So it's part anthology and part magazine. And what I mean
part
by
anthology
that,
and part magazine.
Part anthology, part magazine. What I mean by that is it features quiet horror short stories. What that means is it's not extreme horror. I know extreme horror is selling the best of all the different horrors, body trauma horror, extreme horror, splatterpunk. I'm going in the opposite end. Think of like Stephen King's Night Shift. You could read that and give it to your nephew. That's what Soul Scream Anthology is. But it has stories like an anthology. But each story is followed by an author profile on that author, right? So you have a magazine feel there. And then there are pop culture essays about some famous element, like we've done Mina Hawkins from Dracula. And an upcoming one has a memoir style writing about an indie director whose love of the movie Heat led to him making his own movie called Clandestine. Upcoming will be an essay on Brody from Jaws, Ripley from Aliens. So you have all of that too. However, now, those profiles, author profiles, are done by three interns, and each have a different voice. And then the assistant editor, Desdemona de la Cruz, is that also one of the main characters in a recurring series of short stories. What we wind up having is a cast. Think of, instead of The Office, think of the Soul Screen production office. And we get to see them interact a little bit behind the stage or whatever. And that story is evolving across what are planned now to be five issues, the teaser and four volumes of Soul Scream. So we're halfway through the story, and the third and fourth part are going to be out in August. So it'll be you can do a complete summer reading. And yeah, how it's developing.
This is major effort here on your part, sir, because you are, as we said before, a one-man army. Yes. So with you having to cover, I know you've written at least some of the material in the book magazine. You had to reach out to other editors who submitted their material. Who submitted their material. You then had to screen the material until you found the pieces you wanted to use.
Right.
Edit some of those pieces to fit into the format properly. You've had to also deal with all the editorial aspects of the magazine above and beyond the actual stories and articles, and which covers the cover and the cover art and all of that. And then uploading it to whatever platform is going to make it available for sales, figuring out prices, all these things. So what could possibly go wrong in the midst of all that simple activity, sir?
One thing is keeping contact. We have about 30 or 40 authors involved now. So keeping in touch with all of them and being prompt and current, I have dropped the ball most with prompt, especially the people who submitted early but were slotted for issues 3 and 4. They finally got their contracts this week. So they have been waiting for a little while for those. Making sure you pay everybody. I keep a list and then a list on the list. And I use one of these four color pens. And each color means, yes, I sent, then no, didn't come back, or this, or finally, you're right, paid. And it's all written on. I print out the stories so that I can look at anything that I made note of, but also keep track at the top, contract sent. I think it goes, when it's approved, I write send contract. And then when the contract is sent, I cross out send. So it says contract sent. And then when it comes back, I read through it, make sure we have everything that we need, which is the signed contract, a short bio, and answers to an interview that we send them for the profile. If all that's done, then I send payment as agreed. And then I write paid on it so that I know at a glance this person is covered or not. So all that has to go on.
It's send, sent, signed, paid, payment. No, payment. Paid. There we paid. Go. Yes. Paid. Paid is the last one. Send, sent, signed, payment, paid. There we go.
And across the top also is the name of the volume it'll show up in. So I have a pile here that has Monstrous Hearts scrolled across it, and then on the pile underneath that, the fold underneath that, all of them have Science Runs Amok written across it, because those there are the part 3 and 4, or part 4 and 5, I guess you would call it. But when we published, one of the things about indie publishing, for those of you who are considering indie publishing, one of the things that gives you the power to do, since most times you're not staffed like Simon and Schuster or one of those bigger places, and you do everything yourself, you might miss something. But you can always put the correction in and then upload again. So I uploaded, and one, there was a hilarious mistake where it was saying I was misrepresenting the imprint. My overall company's name is Seamus and Nunzio Productions, and they were saying that they didn't recognize that. It turns out the very first time I used it, I had a typo in it, because the name of the company is Seamus and A&D Nunzio Productions, LLC, Limited Liability Corporation. And because I am a super stellar talent here, I put a period instead of a comma.
So
now that is how Amazon recognizes my company's name. I have to fix that, right? And that's what that held me back. And then the cover was getting rejected because it was 0.067 of an inch off.
Jeez.
Not the binding, the writing on the spine.
Fine.
It needed to be a little shorter, so I had to go and get that fixed. So then you upload that again. So I uploaded everything, and it all came out, and we're published now. That is fantastic. And, of course, that's when you look through it to gloat. When you can do that on the ebook, you just look inside and you go. And I got to the table of contents, and I said, oh, my God. Because you don't catch these things until you hit publish.
Out in the public eye, yeah.
I had printed, the first time it happened normally, but this time for some reason it didn't. I published the titles of the stories, but not the author names. So I went back, I used Atticus, which is a writing and layout form, but I use it for the layout platform. And after doing a little research, I noticed that there are two checkboxes you have to check for the names to appear.
For the writers' names to appear next to the titles. Okay.
So it was a very easy fix. And then I had to export it again and then upload it again. And then now it's republished. So now we're fantastic. We're ready for the parade.
Yep.
And I always send out an email to everyone in that issue. So one, they know they're in that issue. And then two, to know that it's live. And I do that. And a writer almost immediately writes me back. Because I told him, this is out now, it's live, and I'll be sending contributor copies as soon as they come in for me. And she writes back, and she says, I happen to be reading through it, and I read on the copyright, my story's not listed under the reprints, and it was reprinted. Does that make a difference? And I said, yeah, hold on. And I went back to the contract, because that's why you have to have signed contracts, and that's why you have to keep them on file, everybody. And I looked it up. I had missed it. So I got the information. I opened up the file on Atticus again. I added that listing as it being reprinted. Not because anyone can get sued, but because it is the right thing to do. Give the credit.
My goodness, ethics.
You have to have it or else you're not professional. So then I exported it and I uploaded it and I published it again, and there you go, and it keeps going. So I think I wound up doing seven publishings before the seven different cracks in my armor there.
Yeah.
But it is live. Well, it's right on Amazon, ebook or print. Soul Scream Anthologine, Volume 2, Dark Justice. So now you can get three parts of the 5-part story.
Yes.
You can get. And it is a series, so you can look at it. And listed as the first one, or number one, is Come All Ye Faithless, the Christmas one. And that has a story that is tied to the Office arc, hint, hint. And then the blue we showed you before, that is part two, and it's just called Soul Scream Anthologine. And then the third one is Dark Justice. The fourth one will be Monstrous Hearts. And the fifth one will be Science Runs Amok. And the very end of that one will be What Happens.
Yeah, that's usually what the end is. Yes.
You're not going to tell us
what that is. Oh,
I'm not going to. I didn't even tell Glorious, and I tell her everything.
Oh, my goodness.
I tell Glorious everything. In the morning when she's trying to have a quiet cup of coffee, blah, 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 blah. In the afternoon when she's just trying to relax from work. At night when she's trying to read. At night when she's sleeping. Oh, yeah. Everyone should have a little mercy on Glorious and pray for her strength, because I don't shut up. But when I told her that, I realized the arc was created and I could finish it in such a way. And then I stopped and said, I'm not telling you. And she said, that's never happened before.
Oh.
So let's see.
Oh, okay.
I even know what happens after the end. Dun, dun. All right, enough of that. So ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to be indie publishing, know that you can perfect Don't sell yourself short. Don't sell your product short.
Yes, you can. Even if it takes seven times, it takes what it takes.
It doesn't matter. You got to get it right. That's why these things are being rebooted, the novels, because now they will stand the test of time for me that, yeah, that's the best that I can write that book. And let's move on. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much for all that. That was wonderful. Wunderbar. Revealing. Transparent, even.
There you go.
And again, hopefully you guys, that informative. And encouraging and inspiring, because again, we know many of you are tackling, if not major projects like this, multiple layered projects, you are tackling maybe your first story, your first short story, your first play, whatever. Just understand, you keep at it.
Trust the process and keep going and read your work out loud as if you're getting paid a ton of money to do so. And you'll find the letters. The secret of writing is having the discipline and the heart to go back and rewrite, make it suck less until you're like, yes, this is what the world should say.
Because rewrites are your friends. They really
That's
are.
Right.
They really
People have a hard time and they think that first time has to be best time. But
Oh, it's got to be perfect. No, it's got to be perfect. Before I even type the word out, I have to have the absolutely right word.
You're cheating yourself on that.
Still waiting for the right word. Spew it out, upchuck it, get it onto the page or the screen, and then go back and start to knead it and fix it and refine it and all that.
Yeah.
You know what? So this leads into what we said we would do today, which is some frequently asked questions, some FAQs.
Yeah.
So I have a list here of seven, and I thought we could do a sort of a back and forth here.
Sure. Why don't I ask you the first one? And you answer it, and then I'll add a little something.
Okay. I can do it. See, we're like winging it here, folks. We hadn't said how we were going to do this, but this is fine. This is fine.
Alex Simmons.
What? Huh? Oh, yes.
The writing community as a whole asks you. All right, so the first question is, how do I write a story that takes place in a location I don't know?
That's a tough one, Batman. No, seriously. It's funny. There are different approaches that one can take, and certainly that I've taken to that. But I'm going to focus on one in particular. At a point in the earlier part of my career, I had an opportunity to do a mystery series storyline, or more of an adventure series storyline, for a three-part novel. And it took place in three different geographic locations that I had not been to. And there was a part of me that said, you can watch documentaries, you can go to the libraries, you can pull things up from the internet and piece all of this together so that you have visuals to help you see what places look like. You can read information from people who've been there and gather that information and use what you want of that. And also, I like to add sometimes not just straight factual nonfiction information, but I also sometimes like to read material of people who visited the place and talk about how that place made them feel, so that I can add some little nuances there that might make it feel more authentic, more real. So I had those options. And for one of the locations, I did do that. But I also felt with this particular story, the first one, that I really needed more. And so what I did was I went to this location. Now, again, this could be someplace in your community. This could be someplace in another city. This could be any number of things. But what I did was I took a little bit of the advance I got on the assignment, and I bought a ticket to Kenya, and I went to Africa. It was my first time in Africa. It was a camera safari, because the story that I was writing takes place out on the Serengeti, out there in the wild. And I, of course, am not one of those adventurers who puts on a backpack and goes walking into the wilderness on his own. I knew what I didn't know. So I became a part of this group, and I wasn't about to shoot and kill anything. So I had my camera. And what happened was a wonderful experience of, yes, I could see the terrain. I could get a sense of the heat and the feel of the sun. I could meet some of the people and get a sense of the environment and the culture. But the other thing that it added was a sense of smell and a sense of concern or potential danger. I was never really in danger. We didn't have to like hand wrestle any beasties, but we were around them. And when you're in a vehicle and about 30 feet away, there is an elephant and you're not at the zoo, and the elephant is letting by flapping its ears that you're too damn close, you get a sense of the power of these creatures. And that gives you a visceral experience that you can put into your stories. Long-winded answer to the story is, yes, you can do research through a library, through the internet, through books, through talking to people who've been to that location. But if you can, if it's affordable, if it's doable, if it's possible, I also suggest that you go to a location to get some sort of input, tactile, scent, sound, sights that you can take in that will help leave an imprint on you, and subsequently you can then channel that into your story.
A quick phrase to remember to regarding all that is, the map is not the territory, right? You look on a map, you might see how something looks. That doesn't tell you how it is. Being there, like you said, sight, smell, touch, and all those things are really backbone of writing a convincing location. He said, and then he contradicted it. I myself very rarely write extreme details about location. If we're in a living room, unless there's some elements that affect the story, I assume you're seeing, I'll give you maybe a sentence or two. The furniture was old, like grandma's house. Mm-hmm. And you fill in the blank there. There was one in the former City of Woe, which will now be Mallory and Gunner Infernal. They go to one apartment and there are doilies everywhere. And there's so many, and it's obsessive. Then we put something like that in. Mm-hmm. But usually I don't. One of my current projects takes place in a couple of locations, one of it which was Pittsburgh. And the only research I did was because it was in the streets. The only thing I did was I looked up some and just mentioned them. So if you're a local, you're like, oh yeah, I know where that is. And that's because the story was 700 or 1,000 words long. So I didn't need a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In Infernal, there's an entire chase scene in the Bronx. And I mapped it out very carefully and drove it and was able to add in this landmark or that landmark to help bring, it was in the service of the chase, not in the service of the location. I didn't want to talk about the glories of that stretch of the Bronx. I wanted you to feel the lefts and the rights and the dangers. For me, it's always served the story. And it depends. Alex Simmons, if you read one of the Blackjack Rapid Read series that has Alex in it, in my style, you get to really see the two different styles. Alex tends to have the first page or two kind of front-loaded with information and five senses, so you get a feel of location and you get a feel of all this. And I think the shot or the first punch is thrown in for me in within the first three paragraphs. I go right away, blah blah blah. So either way, but I agree with you. Knowing the terrain, especially if that terrain is part and parcel of the story. You wrote a story featuring Aaron Day's sister. That's going to be in the third Soul Scream. And that was in a very dry region of the United States, right? So all that meant something. In volume two, Teal does a story called, Teal James Glenn does a story called Voice of the Desert. It's right in the title. The climate of the desert. the land, what you can see, the sky, the sand, the hills, the aridness, all of that played a very important part of the plot. So he spent more time with it. So it served the story.
Yeah. In filmmaking, too, I often say when you're writing a screenplay or a script, unless, just like you said a moment ago, unless a description of a particular piece of furniture or a garment or things like that is key to what's happening in that scene, you don't have to go any further with that other than, like you were saying again, it was an old apartment like your grandma's house, or it was a dingy, rundown hotel or motel find on a highway. Let people fill in some of the other features, or, and again, in films, your set designer, your director, they're going to bring in the details that are necessary to flesh that out. So anyway,
so it's interesting. Even in comic book writing, there'll be a different style. Someone might just write exterior haunted house day, but Neil Gaiman will write a page and a half about how many crows are in which limbs of which trees. And he does it in a very charming fashion, talking right to the artist. But the result is the Sandman series. And if you've never seen that, go somewhere and get a look in it. But it all depends on what kind of story you're telling.
Yep, and your style. So let's go to question number two. Yes. Chris Ryan, this is a question. How do I write a story about a time period that I don't know?
Yeah, the only time I've ever done this is writing for Alex. Honestly, I tend to write modern stories. But Alex Aaron Day is set in the 1930s mostly, right?
Yep.
That's Blackjack, by the way. We gave you his daytime name, or his off-hours name. Aaron Blackjack Day there. And that's set in the 30s. I have to research. And one of the things I did was I had a friend, a library friend, and she would look for stuff in the 30s that was being weeded out. And she had fashions of the 1930s and then cars of the 1930s and I think like buildings or something. So she gave me those books so I would look through so that I would have an idea of those and I'd slide them in. But I only use like a phrase to describe it. I'm not one to go into acute style on if he wore a pork pie hat or if he wore a fedora. That's about all you're going to get, maybe a brown fedora, and move on to the character work. But if it's a time period, go and see what they have on YouTube as far as videos. Sometimes you see some historian talking about Chicago in 1928, and he'll have some still photographers, or she'll have some anecdotes and some photography. Or if it's further back, you got to go for histories and look at it and go for multiple sources.
Mm-hmm.
Because one person's going to describe this one way. It'd be interesting, say you're going to do Nazi Germany, right? They get the American one. It's going to talk about the evils of Nazi. And if you're talking about the other side, you might get a different feeling. I remember way back, over 30 years ago, I was trying to teach World War II to a Bronx, I think it was an seventh or eighth grade class, and the past wasn't ringing for them. Martin Luther King was as real to them as George Washington or the Lucky Charms character.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get some reels.
Yeah.
We were talking about Mussolini. What's that, mozzarella? What are you talking about? You know? So I interviewed my in-laws who grew up in Italian governed land, one in Sicily, one in North Africa, and both under Mussolini. And they were talking about when we were kids, how you pledge your
American flag, allegiance
to the flag.
Yeah.
They pledged to Mussolini every morning. And the father was a little mini, like we would have Boy Scouts here. He was a brown shirt. And they had no clue. They said we were children. We had no clue of his politics or plans or demeanor. We just knew that he made things better because they were born into the Great Depression. And to get that perspective, they said, and she said, of course, eventually everybody learned what he was about, and he was chased down and hung in the street, which was a alarming turn for my eighth graders to hear about from a sweet little lady who was making pasta.
Gotcha.
But if you can go to a source about what was it like in that time period, do find the diaries, find recordings, biographical video, all that stuff, as much as firsthand stuff as you can get. And yes, that means all the old people are now much more valuable to you as resources than you may have.
Absolutely. I would also say that you can also find, because I did this as well, find old newspaper articles. And if you can, find newspapers that were, and you can find on microfiche or somehow recorded in libraries or online even, but find newspapers, magazines that were printed during that time, because the ads, the photographs, images, illustrations, things really give you a feel of the era. I think what both Chris and I are saying too is you can do it depending on the needs of the project. You can do your research to an extreme degree, really dig in there and get micro about it, or you can gather enough information to help you generate a flavor or feel of that era. Yeah. But do it to serve the story. Yeah. Do the work to serve the story.
When we did Fire and Ice, the story starts in Berlin, but I was going to have blackjack right after the Olympics, and I was going to have blackjack off those, away from that train station, off that area, into woods almost immediately. So I think I did 2 or 3 hours of research on the Berlin Olympics and the Berlin train station.
Mm-hmm.
Just got enough for those first couple of paragraphs and off we went. And then the woods, what I did with it, you'll have to read. But
yes, you will.
Okay, sir.
Yes.
How do I write a story about a lifestyle I've never experienced?
Now, you guys may be picking up on a theme here. How do I write something I've never done, seen, traveled to, and so forth? And it's inevitable, because even when my students, and I know Chris has experienced this too, you give them you can write your own original story. A lot of times they will want to write something that's sort of an homage, let's put it that way, a tribute to their favorite film or their favorite book. And so they're going to want to write about something that they haven't done, haven't experienced, haven't lived, but they saw it in a movie or they read it in their favorite book. And so that's one of the reasons that some of these questions lean in that direction. Because again, starting out as a writer, A, you don't have to write a novel first. You can write short stories are valid. Articles are valid. All of that. Memoirs are valid. But to understand how to take on fiction when you're going to write about things you've never done or seen, I think is key. How do you write a story about a lifestyle you've never experienced? Again, very much like we've been saying, you do your homework. Interviewing people, absolutely. Do research in terms of, again, the library, YouTube, any of these things that will give you a visual representation. And then hopefully, I would say the human factor, trying to find out what it was like for people who existed during that time or who lived that lifestyle, who have been there, done that. And one of the things also Chris said a little while ago about more than one source, that's also key for a couple of reasons. We all have our opinion about a thing. How some people feel about growing up in the country is different from how other people will feel about it. Some people might want to get away real quick, get to the city, live that life. They hated being in the country. They hated being in the woods. They hated being on a farm. Whereas others, this was nirvana. This was a dream. They felt the earth. They were rooted in it. They were where they belong. So to get several opinions, I usually try and go for no less than three.
Right.
To get several opinions of the experience so you can see it a little bit more from a more than one angle gives you some better material to work with and also influences how you handle your character. If your character grew up in another country or at another social economic level or another race or another religion, if you can get more information about this lifestyle or that place, it makes your character come across as more authentic, more genuine. And then your audience will believe or buy into it. And then your story will be even more intriguing and compelling. So that's the simple answer to that.
All I would add to that is you can have people check your work. Mallory and Gunnar Inferno, in its original incarnation of City of Woe, I had a friend, former roommate, who was a sergeant of detectives in Manhattan and was very excited about kicking my ass on anything I did wrong. So he more than happily agreed to read and consult on every chapter. So even when every sentence, every phrase, he was really thorough. And his payment was lasagna dinner from my wife.
Oh, really?
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Dynamite.
There's a reason why those police ring true is because a policeman looked and knocked out all the times I made an error. But that goes for any kind of lifestyle. I recently, I just mentioned before that I recently wrote something and that takes place in Pittsburgh. And I had thrown up just a couple of street signs, that kind of stuff. But when a person read it who has some Pittsburgh experience, he says, you mention them as Pittsburghian. That's not what they refer themselves as. Uh-huh. They're Pittsburghers or they're Yinzers.
Yinzers.
What's a Yinzer? And he says, that's a phrase they use a lot if they're born and raised in Pittsburgh. And the character you're talking about, the way he's behaving, he definitely would be a Yinzer. So in that one place where I reference Pittsburghers, I'll go in and change it to Yinzers. Yeah. And I tell you what, it's you, trans people, LGBTA, TIA, anyone who's a person of a different color than you, whatever your color is, that doesn't give you a universal ticket to, that's how we get stereotypes. And we've had about 150, 200 in modern literature, years of stereotypes. We're moving away from that. And the way to move away from that is to reach out and say, did I get this right? Am I being respectful? There can be some overstep. I submitted a story one time, and it was someone who's going to read and talk about whether the story was ready for submission. And one of the things the person said was, this is... there's no other lifestyles in here, in this detective unit. There's no gay people, or there's no, I forget what else he was saying, there was a lack of. He says, it's not representing everybody. I said, have you been to a NYPD detective squad? it's not the colors of Bennington. It's not that ad. There's whoever's making up the bulk of the force, and that's these days Spanish, African American, white guys, Asian, Filipino women, and more and more gays. But for the time this story was happening, there was still a lot of closeting going on. So, for all he knows, one of the one or two line detectives that's in there might be. But the two main from, you know, the two detectives that are telling that story, they don't know about it. And it's not that there was nowhere in that story for everyone to be represented. It was really a as wild as that story is. It goes all over New York City, and New York City doubles as Dante's Inferno. And there's representatives of New York City types all through that.
Okay.
But New York City's not the most sensitive. One person said, you have an Indian person running a corner, a stationery, a newspaper store. I said, yeah, because I've been in New York City. He says, well, that's not progressive. I said,
that's how he's making his living.
I'm not putting him down. I'm not mocking him. I'm not making him a stereotype. I'm giving the flavor of New York City. And then up the block, there was another store owner who was a very progressive, fearless African-American store owner who gave those two detectives holy hell. I had no problem with that one. There's both in New York City.
That's life. That is life.
You know? There are two guys who are really high when they're talking to the detective. There was no problem with that because, you know what, there are people in the neighborhood. There were stuck up people, and they were definitely white racists in there. And I want to write the mosaic. I want to write the tapestry. So I'll be sensitive whenever I can. But if the idea is that we're trying to thread that needle, I'll take that dare. And I'll represent, for example, New York City, which I write about a lot. As I experience it, when I go and do all my research by living my life running around New York City.
There you go.
So you have to balance it, because it can be, yes, you want to be sensitive and you want to
You want to be sensitive. You also want to serve the story. You want to if you really want to represent, then represent, in which case there's yin and yang. There's give and take, there's high and low, and that's really what it is. It's inclusivity is exactly that. Include those who are there. That's really the story. We got to do the work to
make sure you're not letting yourself out of actual writing stereotypical stuff. You got to play with it and make sure you're being the very best you can be at that. All right. So you're reading this next one?
Yeah, we're going to do one more here. So here we are. Number four. Should I only write about fictional events, people, and places?
Depends. Are you writing fiction? What kind of fiction are you writing? Are you writing fantasy? Then, yeah, the places should be fictional. Unless you're going to write fantasy elements into a real setting. There's no reason why you can't have dwarfs and minotaurs and whatever running around New York City. Okay, what is it that you want to accomplish? What's your goal? How do you serve your story? Should you only write about fictional events, people, and places? I don't. I had Teamsters in Infernal and The Who, or Who Remains of The Who. In a Race Against Time episode, you and I went back and forth because the characters in this Race Against Time adventure had to take a cab in London. And I wanted them to jump in a yellow cab.
Yep.
And when the cabbie turned around visually, it would look like Ringo Starr.
Yep.
And it would allow him to make all these yellow submarine puns. But we'd never call him. We would never Ringo. Call him Ringo or anything like that. So my man over here was cautious. And I remember resolving this by writing to Dave. I forget his name now. Dave Simon, I think is his name. I forget. The creator of Cerebus the Aardvark.
Oh,
Dave Sims.
Yeah.
Dave Sims. And I explained the situation and I said, you use people, historical figures all the time, Mick Jagger, Hemingway, all that. Because, yeah, he says, call fair use. If you're not making fun of them, you're not claiming they're really who you say they are, you can represent that and the audience will pick up on it and it's fair use. And I show that letter to you and that's what calmed you down. And that's why that character shows up in the way that he does. I recently had a guy pitch a story for Soul Scream, and he says it's a new take on Jason Voorhees. And I said, do you have license permission to use Jason Voorhees in that way? And let's just say he did. So I said, well, give me another story. And I'm glad I did, because the other story was fantastic. But that kind of thing, if you don't have license to somebody, you know.
That's different.
Yeah. However, you know, was it that we recently saw? It might have been Spider-Man, or it might have, I don't know. Who do we have on last episode? Kevin.
Kevin Grievous.
Yes, and Kevin Grievous' new comic book, his characters are very much winks and nods to leading DC and Marvel characters. But that's what they are, winks and nods.
Yep.
He's not violating trademark and all that. So all that has to be considered. If you're writing, if your story is, I want it to be about New York City, and I wanted to be about these people. We go back to the previous answer about being sensitive and doing the right thing, doing them justice. But it depends. If your story takes place in Guala of the Samara system, okay, that's where it takes place. Make that as real as you can. But if it takes place in Brooklyn, like Desdemona de la Cruz, assistant editor of Soul Scream, and her adventures, they start in Brooklyn. Then do your research as much as you need and make that real. Serve the story.
And what I will just piggyback on that is, again, if I understand the question, is should I only write about fictional events, people, and places? And I would say, why would you only do that if you have an interest or a story about something non-fictional?
True.
So we could be talking about memoirs, and we can be talking about historical events. We could talk about incidents. If you were writing an article about something that goes on in your city, town, state, country, whatever, it's important to you, and it's based on, or not even based on, it's reflecting real circumstances and real people. Why would you hold back on that? Yes, you can be cautious. There's such a thing as slander and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So you want to be cautious about who you're talking about and what you're sharing, what kind of information do you have the right to, and on that sort of thing. But absolutely, nonfiction material is as valid, if not more so, than fictional material, depending on what you're working on. And I'll also point out, for instance, again, Chris is always referring to the many moons that I've been on this planet. When I was a younger
man, me?
Documentaries were very staid, very conservative, and I don't mean that politically.
And silent. They were silent movies. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to hurt you later. They were this almost like information that we're giving you about this, but so almost boring. Let's just call it that at times. It's quite boring because of the style of storytelling, even though it's factual, the style of storytelling that the majority of the documentarians were using was give you this information because this is not supposed to be an action adventure or whatever.
Right.
Then came along, Kim Burns said, guess what? I can give you all this factual information, but I'm going to filter it through a Hollywood action film or suspense film filter or theme. I'm going to build, I'm going to give you a little bit of exposition, then I'm going to give you an inciting incident, I'm going to give you rising action, I'm going to give you a climax, I'm going to give you all this stuff, and you're just going to be sitting on the edge of your chair listening to information about the Civil War, baseball, jazz, you name it, I can do it. And I can make it salivatingly interesting.
Yeah.
And that's telling a great story, no matter what the material is. So nonfiction is fair game as far as I'm concerned. Just tell it the best you can and understand that it's not just giving dry toast to the masses. It is sharing information, hopefully, that you're passionate about, or you're excited about, that you feel is important. Share that information in a compelling and intriguing way so that we want it. We want to swill it down, gobble it down, and ask you for more.
I want to add two quick ones. We grew up, or we were on the same planet, in the 70s.
Yep.
And therefore, we got the treat that was, this is the NFL. And it would be the highlights of the week, but it had one of these commercial-type voices that would make everything sound bigger than life, more exciting than, it sounded like a Doc Savage adventure, and it was a pass, a throw, a tackle. That's nonfiction, but it was done in an elevated fashion. And everybody understood. They didn't take it as, this is a newscast. It was something else. It was heading towards the other thing I want to talk about, which was, this is back when you were only in your 30s, the World War II,
I hate you.
Why We Fight propaganda films. And you have to be careful that your nonfiction or your history, historical fiction, or reality-based fiction is not slanted towards propaganda. Unless that character, that's part of his character or her character or their characterization. Again, know your story, serve your story.
Yep.
And Alex, when I saw the original list of these questions, I knew this was going to be a two-parter.
Yeah.
Because I knew we would get really interested in saying whatever we can, and we need to come back and answer the rest.
So we'll be back next week with the next thrilling episode of We'll Be Back Next Week. No, we'll pick up with this the next time. I found information on the Soul Scream update very exciting. I'm really looking forward to the next issue. Let's just quickly go back over that in a second. And then I hope that you found the information to some of these questions also useful. But Chris,
yes,
one more time, when is Soul Scream coming out? What's the next issue?
The first three parts are out on Amazon right now. That's Come All You Faithless. And then volume one doesn't have another title. And then Dark Justice. And they're all out there now. And then we have two more parts coming out, Monstrous Hearts and Science Runs Amok. And those will both be out before Labor Day.
Whoa.
And then I'll be dead.
No, he'll be on vacation. He'll be comatose. Yes.
I cannot believe the drive I have for this and the amount of work it's taking. But my God, it's fun. And there are so it. I used to love as a kid a stack of comic books, and you read a whole bunch of different stories in different styles. That's this. And then to read about the authors and get to know behind screen, I always loved that. And to have this story now weaving through it, man, I'm having a ball, and I'm hoping others will enjoy it as well.
Yes,
you can get those on Amazon. Just go to Soul Scream Anthologine. All three will pop up.
There you go. Okay, that's it for now, folks. We will be here again next week with even more Q&A and a few more exciting bits of information. And then, oh, and later this month, we have two interviews coming up with some exciting guests. So stay with us, be here, and as Jack Lord used to say, aloha.
Felt that coming.
Take care, Chris. Take care, everybody.
Okay, thanks, man. Peace.